Greetings, listeners, if any, and welcome to DM Dad, the podcast about running D&D and other RPGs for kids. A great way to spend time with your family now that your friends are too old and have all moved away. So, one thing that's been making the rounds with the Anchorites, as Tim Shorts pointed out in his most recent podcast, is the Appendix N. The inspiration for your gaming, and especially your gaming world, or things like that. You know, Follow Me and Die did an episode on that as well, which I actually phoned into. And I thought I would just do a whole episode on my Appendix N. I mean, I read a lot. I've always been a really avid reader ever since I was a kid. Probably one of the reasons why I want to be a writer as well. So I could go on and on and on about things that I have that have influenced me in some ways, but there's two things in particular which have influenced my my game world, my homebrew game world, and those things are the poem, the Anglo-Saxon poem Beowulf, and the 80s film Dragon Slayer. So we'll start with Beowulf. I can still remember the first time I read Beowulf in translation, obviously, because you have to learn Old English if you want to read it in the original. I was still in elementary school in California, and it was a substitute teacher day. And I don't know, and I probably never will know, whether this was something the regular teacher had told her to run. I feel like this was one of those random days where the regular teacher got sick and had to call into work, and they needed to get a sub in quickly. So my impression has always been like this was something where the sub got called in at short notice. They just, you know, bring something. They're this grade, this age, bring something appropriate. Fill in the time. It's probably a 24-hour virus. The regular teacher will be in the next day. So she brought in Beowulf. She had photocopied the poem, so we all got a little stapled kind of handout that had the text of the poem. It's only 3,000 lines. It's not that long. It had a little bit of introduction. It had a little bit of quotes from the original Anglo-Saxon, and a brief description of you know, how Old English used to work and how different it used to be. Up until then, if somebody said, "What's Old English?" I would have probably said, "Oh, like Shakespeare?" It's like, no, it's a completely different language. My first thoughts were, Beowulf, what kind of a name is that? That's stupid. What does that even mean? By the way, it actually means literally wolf of the bees, but that's a kenning for bear, so it means bear. And it's like, I've never heard of this. What's this about? Then my second thought was, it's in a column like a poem, but it doesn't rhyme, and it's telling a story. What's up with that? Because I thought poems should rhyme, and I thought poems were like song lyrics. They should be about feelings or flowers or something like that. It's funny because a lot of nursery rhymes are ballads, but I remember being really put off initially that somebody would bother to tell a story in a poem. It's like, no, a story should be in prose. But as I started reading it, all that went out the window, and I was just amazed. And then I remember thinking, how come I've never heard of Beowulf before? I've heard of King Arthur and Lancelot. I've heard of Robin Hood. I've even heard of Achilles and Odysseus. You know, how come I've never heard of this guy? This guy ripped a monster's arm off with his bare hands. Then he went underwater and killed the monster's mother. And then he fought a dragon. You know, how come we haven't all been talking about, how come this isn't one of those mythical figures that everybody knows about, even if they haven't actually read the original story, you know? So that was my first encounter with Beowulf. Later on, I met Beowulf again because when I was an undergraduate at the University of Denver, my initial intention was to study 20th century literature because it was still the 20th century and I wanted to be a 20th century author. I probably should have just studied creative writing, but I didn't because I'm weird. So I thought, instead of studying how to write, I'll study books and I'll learn how to write well from books. They're like, well, you have to do a foreign language as well. You can't just do English literature. So I picked German because I had done German in school. And as I was doing German in college, I was like, you know, something that's always, you know, struck me is that how many words in German are similar to words in English? Words like Hand, which means hand, and Fuß, which means foot, you know, and Fußball, which means football, and things like that. You know, there are loads of words that are different, but there are loads of words that are similar. And it's like, what's up with that? And my prof's like, oh, well, English and German are related. They're like sister languages or maybe like cousins, you know, but they have a common ancestor. And I was like, really? Wow. It's like, so how far back do you have to go before they're similar? And she didn't know specifically because she wasn't like a medievalist. But she's like, probably, you know, like Old English is probably quite similar to Old High German and stuff. So, you know, you couldn't study Old High German at my university, but you could study Old English. So I started doing that. And I kind of ended up going more into medieval literature because of that than 20th century. And I kind of left the 20th century behind gradually. But that's where I learned to actually read Old English and to read Beowulf in the original. And you know, I came to know the poem a lot better. And when it came time to start building my fantasy world, that's when, you know, that's what informed a lot of my sensibilities about how I wanted my fantasy world to look like. So what does a Beowulf-esque fantasy world look like? Well, it's low magic and low fantasy. Beowulf, he obviously has some kind of superhuman strength because he's able to rip Grendel's arm off with one hand or with his bare hands. We don't know exactly how big Grendel is. He's not very clearly described. Nobody even really knows what he looks like. But he's clearly bigger than a normal human. For instance, he picks Beowulf up in one hand, and then Beowulf grabs that arm and then rips it off. So Beowulf is clearly, he's got some exceptional or extraordinary strength, but he's not magic. He doesn't have any magical powers. And the people he interacts with are all humans. And nobody at Hrothgar's Hall of Herod has any magical powers. So it's a low fantasy world where the visible world is human. And as long as you're in that visible world, you're probably only going to encounter other humans. It may not be a pretty world. It may not be a safe world. It's effectively the world of the Vikings. You know, the world of the warring Germanic tribes in the Age of Migration. So, you know, marauders can come to sack your town at any given moment, but they would be human marauders, and they would have human weapons, and you would deal with them the way you deal with other humans. But that doesn't mean that there's no such thing as monsters. They're out there beyond civilization, where the light of civilization doesn't reach. And we see this in the poem. Hrothgar is a great king of the Danes. We get his lineage as the poem begins. And then Hrothgar wants to build a mead hall, a big wooden hall where he can sit and get drunk with his warriors and divide his treasure. Because that's what a king does. Every time a king wins a battle, he takes treasure from the losers. But he doesn't keep that treasure. He doles it out lavishly to the warriors who helped him achieve victory, and he gets them drunk every single night. That's how it works. That's how Anglo-Saxon society and how ancient Germanic society works. So he needed a place to build this mead hall, because what's a king without a great mead hall? So he went out into the moors, into what he thought was an uninhabited bit of wilderness. It turns out it was inhabited by Grendel and his mother. And the poem describes Grendel as the spawn of Cain. So it gives the poem as we have it was written by a Christian monk. So there is some Christianization of the poem that probably is not part of the original poem, but it's the version we have. Whether you have the Christianized version of Grendel or not, he's a monster. He's against humankind. And every night, Hrothgar holds a big party for his warriors, and they drink and make merry, and it's very noisy and loud, and there's presumably light from the fires that they have in the hall pouring out, illuminating what would once have been completely dark and barren moor. And in particular, what some of the songs they sing in the Christianized version of the poem that we have is they sing songs about the creation of the world, the biblical story of creation, and that apparently particularly offends him. So what's happened is Hrothgar has moved into monster territory. He's moved away from a civilized part of the country into a wilderness area, and now he is in the reach of monsters, and monsters then come and visit his hall. And they wait for all the warriors to pass out drunk, and then he scoops them up and eats them. We see another aspect of how the wilderness is dangerous and full of monsters when Beowulf talks about the swimming contest that he was in. He and another hero challenged each other to a swimming contest in the open sea. And Beowulf was attacked by sea monsters. I mean, perhaps these sea monsters are really something that exists in real life, like an orca or something like that. Certainly, you can imagine that 1,000 years ago or more, when people didn't know a lot about marine biology, that they did think that actual creatures like orcas and whales and stuff were sea monsters. But the poem doesn't describe these sea monsters as if they're natural animals. They're monsters. And this is another example of Beowulf has left the safety of civilization and swum out into nature, into the wilderness, and encountered monsters there. And he gets dragged to the bottom of the sea, and he has to fight the monsters with just his sword. So that is how magic and monsters work in my setting. As long as you're in town or, you know, in a village or something like that, it's human. Nobody has magic. There's no wizard tower or nobody openly practicing magic. You can't buy magical items, you know. If you want that stuff, you have to go adventuring for it. And once you leave town and go into the wilderness, then all bets are off and there's no telling what you're going to find. But while you're in town, you're going to meet other humans. You're not going to walk into the tavern and find a tiefling waitress and a gnome proprietor. The blacksmith isn't a dwarf. If you want to meet dwarves, you have to go into the mountains and find their hidden kingdoms. If you want to meet elves, you have to go into the woods and find their hidden kingdoms. You know, all the stuff that you would want in your fantasy game exists, but it's not in town. You have to work for it. And the reason I run my world that way is because I'm trying to capture that sense of the sense of the world that you get in Beowulf. So people in Beowulf's time, or when the poem was, you know, first composed, people in the time of the Vikings, or when you get the Eddas, the poetic and the prose Eddas, they never met elves or dwarves because they don't really exist. But they believed in them. They thought they were out there. They never met a dragon because there aren't any dragons, but they believed in them, you know. They never met anybody who could do magic, but they believed that it was possible. It's just not at their house, not in their town or their village, not in their home settlement. It's out there in the dangerous wilderness. And that's where it is in my setting as well. You know, the one thing I really liked about 4th edition, D&D 4th edition, was what they called their points of light setting, where you had a lot of little safe places, and in between them was dangerous wilderness. And I really like running something like that. In fact, the Nentir Valley setting is kind of the thing from 4th edition that I kind of preserve. There is a section of my setting which is basically the Nentir Vale. Anyways, one thing I thought I would do before I stop talking about Beowulf is just, I'm going to attempt to read a bit of it in the original Anglo-Saxon, just the opening lines, which even to this day, I really love them. I really love reading them. They always kind of give me a thrill. Huat we gardena in yera dagum, feod kuninga thrymja frunen, huda ethelinges ellen fremeden. Oft shul shefing sheathen a threatum, monigam magthum meodo settle of teach. Exoda erla, sithen erstwerth fair shaft of unden, he das frofreya bad. Weax under wolknum, weath mundum thach, or that him akwelch, thara sittendra, over hronrad a huren shoulder, gomben gulden, that was god kunning. And what that means, so the first word of the poem is huat, which literally means what, but it's a rhetorical call for attention. It's been translated a lot of ways. One of the most famous translations has so, or sometimes people translate it listen. It literally means what. It's like, you know, when somebody gets your attention, they say what, or something like that. But, you know, listen. We have heard of the Spear Danes, who in days of yore were kings of men. We've heard how those princes did deeds of great valor. Oft shield chefing, the threat of scathes, sheathen a threatum, means somebody who threatens you with lots of injuries. So he's a powerful warrior. He overturned lots of mead benches. It means that he conquered lots of other tribes. He was a fearsome earl, not literally earl as in like the member of the gentry, but that word earl comes from Eorla, which just means a person of upstanding, a person of high social status. And in ancient Germanic society, you got that social status by being a great warrior. So since the time when he was first discovered destitute, so shield chefing comes from humble beginnings. And then it says, he thus frofreya, but he got compensation for that. And then we're about to find out how. He grew under the clouds. He had a mind of a worthy mind. And he grew in power until everybody around him, even over the sea, over the Hronrada, which means over the whale road, had to obey him and give him gold. So basically, Shield Sheffing, who is Hrothgar's ancestor, He came from humble beginnings. He was poor and destitute, but he was a great warrior, and he grew in power until he became such a good king that everybody in all the neighboring tribes and even over the sea had to obey him and send him tribute. And then the last line that I read, that was Godkönig, that was a good king. Because he did what a king should do, conquer everybody around him, take their money, and then dispense it to his warriors. And that basically outlines the kind of world that you're in, a world where people's worth is directly related to their battle prowess. So in some ways it's egalitarian, because Shield Sheffing doesn't come from a noble family. He proved his nobleness by being a great warrior. And remember that a traditional Germanic king leads the battle, leads the army on the battlefield. It's not somebody who stands beside or stands away from the battle and directs it from afar. He's on the front line. And this this leads into my next influence, which is the 1981 film Dragon Slayer. So how is Beowulf related to Dragon Slayer? So Dragon Slayer, a 1981 fantasy film co-produced by Disney and Paramount Pictures, starring a young Peter McNichol, would later be famous for his roles in Ally McBeal and, of course, camp counselor Gary Granger from Adam's Family Values, although I believe, yeah, Dragon Slayer is far and away my favorite film that he's been in. This film was released before Disney created Touchstone Pictures to produce less family-orientated films. So it was apparently controversial because it contains violence, has some very good special effects for the dragon, especially for the time, brief nudity. So, you know, if you thought, oh, it's a Disney film about dragons, I'll take my kids to it, you were probably in for a shock. I watched this film a lot when I was younger. For kind of like the, I don't know, half of the 80s, my brother and I were in a single parent household, and we did not have things like cable, and my grandma did. My grandma, who unfortunately passed away earlier this year, she had cable, and she basically every time a film came on HBO or Cinemax or anything like that, she would tape it, and then she would give those tapes to us. So we always had lots of films to watch, and Dragon Slayer was one of those films, and I watched it loads and loads and loads of times. And then in my teens, I kind of rediscovered it. Actually, not my teens. It was actually after I was already at university. I was going through our basement, and I dug up all these VHS tapes that my grandma had made for us when we were kids. And it's like, oh, Dragon Slayer. By this time, I'd already started learning a lot about, you know, a lot about Anglo-Saxon society that I was just talking about earlier. And I realized some of the subtexts of this film, Dragon Slayer, for the first time. For one thing, it has lateral succession. Germanic society had lateral succession rather than primogeniture. Primogeniture is when the king dies and the king's oldest child, usually oldest male child, although that law has just been changed here in the UK, but oldest child inherits the throne. It's what we think of now as the typical way monarchy works. That's not how monarchy worked in ancient Germanic societies. If the king died, the throne passed to the next oldest male. Usually a brother, perhaps a cousin, conceivably an uncle. It does, you know, another adult male related to the king, probably not the king's son, because there was almost certainly somebody older than the king's son who would inherit the throne then. And the reason for that is because, like I said, the king's first duty is to lead warriors on the battlefield, and that cannot be done by a child. So in Dragon Slayer, a group of people from a country called Urland arrive at a wizard's castle because they're being plagued by a dragon, and they have to tame this dragon. They have to offer a sacrifice of virgin women or virgin girls periodically. And the people are tired of this, so they want somebody to slay this dragon. So they go off in search of this wizard, Ulrich, who's apparently the last wizard. That's made pretty clear. They go through a list of other wizards. Ulrich doesn't want to go on this journey to kill this dragon. And he names a bunch of other potential wizards, and they're all dead. And the leader of this company, a young boy or young man called Valerian, he's like, "You're the only one that's left." So when we finally get to Uruland, we find that the current king, Cassiodorus, is the brother of the previous king, and that king had attempted to slay the dragon and was never seen again. So the throne was inherited not by that king's child, but by his brother. There's a lot of other, names like Ulrich are very Germanic and stuff. Even Urland, right? So Ur is a Germanic particle. When you attach it to a word, you mean the oldest or original version of that. So Urland would be like the original land or something. There were some other things that were very in keeping with Germanic society that struck me once I was aware of them. And that made me pay attention to more subtext. So another thing that was interesting was that in the background, it's not a major part of the film, but it's kind of like a subplot, is while Peter McNichol as the wizard's apprentice is trying to find a way to defeat this dragon, there's a Christian missionary who is slowly converting the people from paganism to Christianity. And in the very end, they actually declare that the dragon was actually the devil or something like that. It's not a huge part of the film, but it is something that keeps going on in the background. And in fact, one of the original party who sought the wizard becomes one of the first converts. And when the original missionary dies and gets incinerated by dragonfire, that convert takes over as the village priest, like the village Christian priest. And the Vikings were kind of like the last of the Germanic people to be converted to Christianity. They kind of held out the longest. On the other hand, most of what we know about their pre-Christian culture comes from Snorri's Eddas. And, he was a Christian. So it's still done through the lens of a later Christianized version, kind of looking back. But the rocky road to Christianizing the northern pagan Germans and Scandinavians is a big part of when you study, early medieval Germanic cultures. And I thought, here's a way that this is kind of happening. Like, you can kind of get a glimpse of it, because the thing about paganism is not an organized religion. Back in the days when they had polytheism, you didn't go to church every Sunday to worship Odin, or I guess Wednesday would probably be a more appropriate holy day for Odin. It wasn't like that, you'll go to Niflheim if you don't worship Odin every week. That's not how it worked. And that meant that people were not really initially very bothered when somebody came in with a new god and said, "You should worship this god." It's probably only when they started to say, "Well, now you can't ever believe in the other gods because this god is the one god that this is the only one you're allowed to worship now," but by then it was like the ball was already rolling, and you can kind of see that happening in this film. And finally, the last detail from this film that really influences how I approach my homebrew fantasy world is, so Valerian turns out to be a young woman in disguise. And the reason she's disguised as a man is because her father didn't want her name on the lottery to be sacrificed to the dragon. And that's also why she led the group of people to find a wizard to slay the dragon, is because she's tired of pretending to be a boy. Also, there's probably only a matter of time before she gets discovered, and she doesn't want to be sacrificed to a dragon. So her father is the village blacksmith, and the wizard apprentice Galen and Valerian, who becomes his love interest, and her father start working on a weapon that Galen can use to slay the dragon. And while they're working on it, the blacksmith says, "All this magic is dying, And that makes me happy because that means the dragon will be dying too. And, you know, that takes you back to the first scene of the film where it's clear that Ulrich is the last wizard and Ulrich dies in the second scene. Galen is, as the wizard's apprentice, is perhaps now the last wizard, but he's actually not a very good wizard. And apparently the dragon itself, Vermithrax Pejorative, is very old and possibly dying as well. Turns out the dragon has baby dragons, so, you know, there is a reason that you need to actually fight this dragon. But that idea that, you know, Galen wants to be a wizard more than anything else in the world. That's like all he's ever wanted to be. That's what he's been spending his whole life training to do. And if magic disappears, that's going to be bad for him. But if with it go mythical monsters like this dragon, that will be good for Erland. And I love that idea that you'd have to make a choice, that you couldn't cherry pick and have good magic and good magical creatures and get rid of the bad ones, get rid of the monsters and the evil magic, that you're either going to have a safe non-magical world, which a lot of amazing things will have to disappear with it, or keep those amazing magical things, but keep the danger as well. So that becomes the central conflict in my homebrew world. And it's a very top level conflict. It's not something that any player characters have had to interact with specifically yet. But if anybody ever did get to a very high level and wanted to participate in some kind of cosmic struggle, that would be it. It would be the whether or not magic is allowed to remain, and with it, all the dangerous, frightening monsters and necromancers and evil gods and things like that, or whether you get rid of magic and turn the world into a carbon copy of the actual medieval world, where, you know, the only dangers are what we would think of as very mundane dangers, and where ultimately civilization will triumph and tame all the wilderness. And I thought it would be interesting at some point to have to put that choice to PCs, especially because almost every party includes a spellcaster. You know, how many parties include an elf? Elves would be one of these things that would have to disappear. All the non-human races would have to go by the wayside if the non-magic side ever won this conflict. On the other hand, if you don't eventually bring about an end to magic, then civilization, as we know, will never advance beyond its present state. It will be kind of permanent faux medieval. So that's a background or top level central conflict. I think Matt Koval said every setting has to have a central conflict that kind of defines every other struggle. And that's the struggle in mine. And I stole that basically from Dragon Slayer, from that one line in Dragon Slayer that influenced me so much, that you can't have the one without the other. If you don't want there to be a possibility that dragons can attack your village or that monsters can come in and raid your village, then you can't also, you have to get rid of magic as well. And you have to kind of have the good with the bad, or you have to sacrifice some of the good to get rid of the bad. In a similar way, you know, the way that Galadriel talks about the power of the elves, and especially what the bearers of the elven rings have been able to accomplish with their rings, that their power, that power will be broken and the elves will diminish if the one ring is destroyed. That's a similar choice. What ultimately will happen at the end of Lord of the Rings is that the magical world of Tolkien will gradually morph into our real world. That's kind of the implication. And then, you know, that's why we don't have things like elves and dwarves and hobbits and stuff anymore. But it was worth sacrificing those things in order to not be, to not have Sauron and orcs and stuff in the world. And I guess the other thing is that, as I mentioned, the, you know, gradual Christianization of Uruland. So I have I have a monotheistic religion in my world, which is an organized religion, and where people have that religion, they don't allow any other faiths, and you do have to go into a church every week and things. And then the other option that you can take as a player character is to not have that religion and to basically, you know, be polytheistic. And basically, I will allow any deity that has ever been worshipped, either in the real world or in a fictional world, because it kind of doesn't matter. They all can coexist, because that's it. Polytheistic religions aren't jealous of each other in the way that monotheistic religions are. You know, monotheistic religions are the ones that tend to be like, this is the only right one. Everyone else is wrong. If you think about, like, in Conan the Barbarian, when Conan is talking about Crom, and Subutai is talking about his god, I forget what his name was, you know, they're not angry at each other, nor do they say that your god doesn't exist. I think Subutai said, my god's better because my god's like the god of the air or something, or the god of the sky or something like that. But it's not like they don't get into a fight over it, you know, because it doesn't matter. And you could probably switch and, you know, or have more than one at the same time. You know, it's pretty lax. And that's how the polytheistic faiths work. It's not even faith per se. It's just sort of like, well, you think these entities are real. And of course, because it's a game, they are real. The other thing is that most polytheistic deities aren't terribly interested in mortals. I think that's based on something from one of the Conan stories where Conan talks about Crom and he says, little cares he for, you know, the fates of men. And I like that idea of the fact that, you know, you have this god and he's technically your god, but you don't have any illusions that he cares about what happens to you. And that if you called upon him for aid, you'd be wasting your breath. You know, I like that idea that, you know, yeah, the gods are real and they're really powerful. And that being the case, why would they care what happens to you? You know, you'd have to do something pretty extraordinary to get their attention. Yeah, but, you know, if you come to my game and roll up a character, you can bring any deity you want with you. It doesn't matter. I'll take anything. Or you can take that monotheistic religion, but then you're going to be kind of more, you're going to be strict. And those are the people who are going to be like, well, your god's evil or doesn't even exist, you know? Anyway, so that's me rambling on about, Dragon Slayer. Before I sign off, I backed the fantasy trip on Kickstarter. I wasn't going to. When people first started talking about it, it's like, well, what is this fantasy trip? And, you know, people are like, oh, it's the precursor to GURPS. And I'm like, no thanks, you know. And then Jim Murphy, Game Methuselah, did a video on YouTube about whether you should back the fantasy trip. He loves it. He played it when it was in print. So he has actual stories about it. And if I'd recommend you go and watch Jim Murphy's video about the fantasy trip and the story he tells about playing in a game that was at a con that was GM'd by Dave Arneson himself, it is one of the best stories of old school gaming I've ever heard in my life. You really need to go and find that on YouTube right now. You know, thank God Jim Murphy has a channel and is telling us stories like that, because those were the days, man. Anyways, he said when he was giving his assessment of the fantasy trip, first of all, he likes it because armor reduces damage rather than makes you harder to hit. And that's one of his DM's pet peeves, or one of his gamer pet peeves, is that he thinks armor should work as damage reduction, not as, you know, improvement to armor class, which he's technically right. But he also talked about being a strategic combat player. And that initially put me off, because combat is my least favorite part of D&D, especially in modern D&D, where combat is basically, let's all take turns rolling our d20s until one side runs out of hit points. And there are any number of blogs and YouTube channels and podcasts full of advice on how to spice up combat in a modern D&D rule set. And none of that would exist if combat weren't so effing boring, you know, as written. So I was like, well, more combat, no thanks. But, you know, then Tankar talked about it in his Kickstarter roundup. In fact, he's talked about it a few times. Some other people started pointing out other aspects of the game that, first of all, it's really quick and really easy to get your head around the rules, which is apparently a sharp contrast to GURPS. Those are magic words for me, quick and easy, because I don't want to be... I don't want to be the gamer who only plays D&D, and I'm not that gamer, actually. I play lots of other systems. But on the other hand, I don't have all the time in the world to learn complex new systems. So a lot of times, if I'm going to get into a new system, it needs to be something that I can get my head around quickly. And also something that I can explain quickly and easily to my kids, because let's face it, I'm running games for my kids most of the time. So quick and easy, that had me... Another one of the quotes was that it's really, really easy to stat up a monster on the fly and know exactly how tough it is. That's great news, because I don't have a lot of time to prep, but also even if I did, I like improvising. I like kind of flying by the seat of my pants. But when I need to make up a random monster, I kind of need to know, you know, how tough is this monster? Not because I want to balance the encounter in the modern sense, but you know, you need to know how tough your monsters are. So that attracts me. So eventually I was like, you know what? I backed it at the PDF level because it's pretty cheap and I'll be able to give it a good, I don't mind running games off PDFs. What I expect from it, at best case scenario, is there'll be something I can use to overlay onto existing games that I'm already running, like maybe my white box game or something like that, or maybe some rules that I can pinch and use as house rules in a game I'm already running. Worst case scenario is it'll be another game we play, another part of our gaming repertoire, and if it's that quick and easy, it shouldn't be that hard to for us to start playing it. Also, it comes with this solo adventure. So I guess, you know, the absolute worst case scenario is that I at least can run those solo adventures for myself. Or are they, I don't know, is it solo and that you run them literally for yourself, or that you run them for only one person? If it's the kind of thing that you run for just one player, so a player and a DM, then I can always run it just for my daughter. She's up for any game. So anyways, yeah, I mean, the Kickstarter is closing pretty soon. So if you haven't backed it and you're at all curious about it, you probably want to get in there, because I think the intention is they are going to release it again, but it'll be more expensive. For instance, like to get the full box set is $60. But apparently once the Kickstarter is over and they start making it, that box set will still be available, but it'll be more expensive. I just got the PDF. Was it £25 or $25 or something like that? I don't know if they're going to do PDF release only after the Kickstarter is finished. But I would imagine that they probably raise the price on everything across the board. So yeah, I have backed it. So when it drops, when the PDFs drop, I will be seeing about adding that to my gaming repertoire. I think for my next podcast, I meant to do it for this podcast, but I got distracted by this Appendix N stuff that's been making the rounds. So the next podcast, I think I will do a comparison of Maze Rats and Hero Kids and talk about the pros and cons of each system, especially as a game that you might run for kids. Until then, play well and let the dice roll where they may.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.